something else I learned last year was to crochet. And so, like, Doctor Who has been my crochet companion. Yeah. So, like, early on when I was doing my blanket, like, I made a huge blanket that's the size of my bed. And it was just, like, constant Doctor Who through that. And then I started working on a Christmas present for my mom. And that's what I did during all that. So, like, generally speaking, that's been my crochet activity is watching Doctor Who. And
it sounds perfect.
It's great. It's very cozy. Every once in a while, you cry a lot. And
yeah. And you can use the little crochet patterns absolutely. To wipe your tears. Yeah. Well, you've got to start crocheting actually Doctor Who things. I'm sure there's patterns for maybe. Daleks. And really, really get into it.
So, I mean, I guess we can sort of transition into talking about, like, what's been happening, like, other than in the last few months, because it's been 3 years, everybody, since we did Cinescope.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I remember it fondly. Also, time is weird. Time is wibbly and wobbly and timey and whimy. But I'll say this now, Chelsea, like, recording Cinescope is one of my, favorite memories of podcasting.
Oh, I appreciate that. And it means a lot knowing that you've been podcasting for a very long time also.
Yeah. But no, it was always, and part of it is, a lot of it is your direction and the concept of the show to be able to talk about the movies we love. And it just felt so freeing. And I love the trajectory of, like, getting to know you better that happened, like, pretty much when you, it started when you first invited me on Cinescope. And through talking about movies, not only that we loved, but which more often than not were personal to us, it really felt like a deeper connection. And I think that your audience probably experiences the same thing listening to people, you know, in the same way. It's kind of a vulnerability when we talk this passionately about stuff. So I just have to say, like, the audience and the opportunity to do this multiple times and keep having me back. And I was like, this is wonderful. And so I've missed it these last 3 years.
Yeah, me too. And thank you for all those very kind things. It really does mean a lot.
Going.
And we've been in contact the whole time too.
Yes, during the hiatus.
And so, like, let's just drop the elephant in the room, however you want to phrase it. So I transitioned, everybody, or am in the process of transitioning. Like, it's an ongoing thing, and that's been going on for just about 2 years now.
Snaps for support and celebration.
Thank you. Eric, I guess I told you what, almost a year ago?
Yeah.
It would have been like March or April, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a large reason for the hiatus, everybody, is like trying to figure out myself and trying to figure out my voice to a certain extent. Like, I liked my voice as far as like podcasting goes. I feel I had a pretty good podcast presentation, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's just like, getting comfortable with, like, I don't want to talk exactly the way I used to, but I don't want to lose what I had also. And so that's still a work in progress. But in general, I'm just so much happier.
Love that.
I've had to have a career change. I made the choice to make a career change so that I didn't have to make a career change. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't want to deal with the stress of and the potential controversy of being a public school teacher in Texas. Who was transitioning. So instead of going through that it would have been about 15 months into my transition, would have been the end of my last school year. And so I moved on, and for a long time, I didn't have a job. I was doing Uber instead, which is, it's got its perks, but I dead name myself every time I go out because I want to be practical and safe, you know? And so, because Texas is what it is. But recently, as in this past week, I just started a job, and it's at my church, which is, I guess, the other big part of this news is that really early on in my transition, I found a local church that is affirming of all LGBTQ people and does lots in the way of social justice and being the right kinds of Christians in the world. And it's been an absolute godsend. It has been a big introduction to a new friend group that I'm a part of and live in the area with now, and I do things with all the time. And now I work at that church, and it's just incredibly special for my first job as me to be at this place that accepted me so fully first before they even knew I was trans, and then months later after I came out to them, has fully accepted the new me. So
yeah,
that's kind of the journey that I've been on over the last couple of years.
I think, you know, if I could tell a story is when you came out to me, I seem to recall it was having to do with your church because they had gotten the name tag printed and
right.
they had it under Chelsea. And that was, it was a very, it was a nonverbal coming out. It was like photo. And I was just like, oh, this is so exciting.
Yeah. I was like, hey, so I have something I want to share with you.
Yeah, I
sent you the picture of, I actually had two name tags made. This was before I came out to the church as a whole, but I was preparing, and they had just made name tags for the people who were on the new member committee, which I had joined. And so I had one with the old name on it to use in the meantime, and then the other one with Chelsea on it for whenever I was ready. And so that's what I texted to Eric. And then Eric was just, I think there was maybe just a tiny bit of confusion at first, like, what does this mean exactly?
Yeah. Oh, right.
And then I just texted the trans flag, and it was like, yes, okay, confirming what you were thinking.
Yeah, I wasn't sure.
Yes.
I was like, did your sister get a job at the church as well? I didn't understand.
Yeah. So... Yeah, and Eric's obviously been hugely accepting and encouraging this whole time too, and it's been awesome. So.
It's just been the most amazing thing to watch you flourish and find, like you said, find community, and especially because the world does not make it easy for trans people and for people, and certainly, I mean, not as easy as it should be, and not easy at all. In fact, the idea that you would have been a target just for being you in your old job is completely astoundingly sad and difficult to kind of comprehend. And so, you know, I have nothing but the utmost respect for that. And seeing you kind of get to a position where you're employed again and able to start up these other life projects that really did bring you a lot of joy, but just which for reasons very understandable to all of us had to be put on hold, being able to bring these things back, and really it all has to do with, you know, keep that which helps you thrive and discard truly everything else. And if things are on hold, you know, indefinitely, awesome. But the idea that you're now at a place where you can bring back the stuff that you love into your life and really surround yourself by all these amazing things that you're doing is really just, that warms my heart, and it's wonderful.
And it should be said that I haven't gone this entire time without podcasting at all. Last year, I had the privilege of being on your show once again. It was Thank You for Spieling, but we rethemed it when the HBO adaptation of one of our favorite video games, The Last of Us, came out last year. And so Eric and I talked through the entire first season, episode by episode, of The Last of Us on HBO on the newly retitled Thank You for Sporing.
Yeah. SPORE-ING. The fact that you said yes to that, especially with everything else that was, you know, going on in your life at the time, and we did it and we went through everything and we were on time and we recorded right after episodes were produced, and like the whole production schedule, it was like the most manic 12 weeks or whatever, like just going back to, because like I don't, you know, we have MuggleCast weekly, but I'm not responsible for all of the moving parts. And so you were a perfect person to co-host that show with, because you and I have this sort of similar levels of professionalism and capability. And the whole process of that season was really just, is again, one of my favorite moments podcasting, but was so easy. And I would certainly love to do that again with you at some point in the future.
Yeah, they're in the process of getting ready to film season two. So I would absolutely come back to do that with you. I'm excited about it. And so, yes, I would love for everybody to go back and listen to that. But I guess this is the other thing to address. One last thing before we kind of move into what we're actually here to do, which is talk about one of our favorite movies. Is that, like, I'm not going to go into the Cinescope archives and change my name on every individual show document. I'm not going to change my name and all the preview descriptions, or like edit my, like, I'm not going to do all that work. I am proud of the stuff that we have put out, my friends and I, Eric and I, all of us that have worked on Cinescope or on Thank You for Spieling and Thank You for Sporing. And so I encourage everybody, if you are interested, to go out and seek it out, but then come back to me and use the right name, please. That would be great.
It seems totally reasonable.
And so going forward, obviously everything is going to be Chelsea. And I don't know, maybe one day I'll change my mind and I'll at least like change the name in the descriptions of but right now it's like that's over 100 episodes. I don't think it's really necessary. I think everybody out there can be kind and reasonable people.
I think so too. And it's funny because of all the things that transition entails, it's like setting priorities. What is needed versus what is absolutely like, if you have nothing else to do, girl, like ever, I can see you going back and changing those show documents. But like,
yeah,
I think you nailed it on the head when you said that people could be, you know, nice and do the new name thing, because I think that certainly with this announcement, and I'm sure it'll come up in the future too, is like, no, from now on, you know, here on out, it's Chelsea. And so people get it. People, seriously, you have to honestly have hate in your heart to not respect somebody enough to use a new name like that. And those kinds of people really shouldn't be listening to our work.
Yeah. In any case, we're here to talk about movies
that we love with our hearts.
Yes. And, you know, we were talking about, like, so I wanted Eric to come back just because, like, I have new people that I am going to invite onto the show as well in the coming episodes. And I'm excited about getting new people on. But, like, for the first episode back in 3 years, I wanted some consistency. I wanted some familiarity.
A legacy guest.
And, I mean, who is more familiar than Eric on this show? And so we were talking about movies, and I said, I'd let you know. And so at first I joked, let's talk about How to Train Your Dragon again.
I know you've revisited a few, like a very few movies, but you've revisited a couple times. So at first I was all right, I'm prepared. But then I remembered that was actually the most recent films that we discussed. So.
Yeah, those were the lead up into the episode 100. And there's only been one episode released since then. So it obviously was a joke, although I really could. And I have some new appreciation for How to Train Your Dragon in the light of life events, because I think I might finally understand more of my obsession with it, you know? So maybe sometime we could talk about it again, but maybe in a bonus episode or something.
Yeah.
But we are here to talk about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Let's see if I can get this old stats routine back down. So this released on December 14th of 2018. It was directed by three people, Bob Persichetti, Peter Ramsey, and Rodney Rothman. It's the only directing credit, actually, for both Persichetti and Rothman, or at least film directing credit. But Ramsey directed DreamWorks' Rise of the Guardians, and then a Netflix series called Lost Ollie, and then a couple of episodes from each The Mandalorian and Ahsoka.
Oh.
It was written by Phil Lord, and it's worth noting that it was also produced by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who are fantastic filmmakers in their own right and largely responsible for getting this off the ground. And it was also written by Rodney Rothman, and Lord came up with the original concept story. The music here was composed by Daniel Pemberton, who I have really come to appreciate over the years. He composed the scores for The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Steve Jobs, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, Molly's Game, All the Money in the World, Ocean's 8, Yesterday, Birds of Prey, Enola Holmes, The Trial of the Chicago 7, The Bad Guys, Amsterdam, Enola Holmes 2, and then this film sequels Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, and then the upcoming Beyond the Spider-Verse, and then one last to throw in, Ferrari. So the reason I included so many is because he's really ramped up in the last few years, because people understand how good he is, and we'll have some things to talk about in the music later. The movie stars Shameik Moore, Jake Johnson, Haley Steinfeld, Mahershala Ali, Brian Tyree Henley, Lily Tomlin, Luna Lauren Velez, Zoe Kravitz, John Mulaney, Kimiko Glenn, Nicolas Cage, Katherine Hahn, Liev Schreiber, I believe it's Liev, and then a little bit of a cameo from Chris Pine. So let's get back into the swing of things, Eric. First experience, do you remember what it was like or when you watched this movie for the first time?
Yes, and funnily enough, I think this may have only been my second time watching the movie.
Oh, wow.
I know, which is shocking for a number of reasons. One, I love this movie. And so this was a movie where when I first saw it, it was in theaters, and I knew instantly that it was a classic. We'll talk a little bit more about that kind of in a moment, but yeah, I saw it in theaters at the Arclight, which was, at the time, it's since closed, a really nice kind of film house in Chicago with just a beautiful, like, lobby, huge, like, tall ceiling with an entire set of like posters and it just make you feel like you're going to a cathedral, and it's like basically, you know, a Botticelli or Da Vinci thing on the side, but it's just movie posters, you know. And I'm just like, this is an amazing place to see amazing films. And I saw it with a group of people that I had done improv with in Chicago, because the theater was actually right across the street. And so this Arclight place was one of our favorite theaters, and coming out of doing comedy classes, we would go and see movies on Friday nights sort of after. And and yeah, you know, going into it the first time, I think I had a lot of spider fatigue. And one of the best things about this film is it's certainly aware of and lampoons every Spider-Man movie that's come out since, let's just say, the year 2000. But it is something new and fresh, and manages to do something that none of the other multiple reboots, multiple sequels, multiple regenerations of Spider-Man managed to do, and does it so well. And so I knew instantly it was a classic, and I would have owned this film on home video, except I stopped buying films on home video around that time, or like 2019, 2020, and then COVID happened. And so the only movies I buy now are ones that Chelsea sends me that are coming out of like Arrow release and special like Hook edition 35th anniversary, you know, the various other vinyl record films and regular movie releases that you can't get anywhere else are like the only home video that I buy, because I've hit my limit. But Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is definitely a film I would own. I'm kind of waiting for the trilogy box set now at this point.
Yeah,
but
that's fair.
As a result, it just was something that kind of, I was like, that was really wonderful. And the sequel Across the Spider-Verse came up and surprised me. I couldn't see it back at the Arclight. I had to go to, I think, the Landmark Century, which is, they do almost exclusively indie films. Anyway, that in Chicago, I didn't have the time to see the first one again. And so I didn't rewatch that prior to watching the second one. Absolutely loved the second one. But so really sitting down, and when you suggested How to Train Your Dragon and then Into the Spider-Verse, I was like, so grateful. Because I'm like, what a great opportunity to rewatch Into the Spider-Verse, especially having seen the sequel and also see like how similar it is, et cetera, et cetera. So I think I got a lot out of this second rewatch, but I just remember the first time being completely flabbergasted, blown away. I still don't think there's many, if any, movies like it.
I want to echo a lot of the stuff that you were just saying, because I definitely, so I'll say I had some Spider-Man fatigue, but really it was a greater superhero fatigue. Ooh. Because going back and revisiting Spider-Man movies, I'm always like, all of these are good. Like, yes, even to me, that means Spider-Man 3. Yes, to me, that even means The Amazing Spider-Man 2. I think there's something to love in all the Spider-Man movies. And this isn't an In Defense Of show, so we're probably not going to cover those movies specifically. But I do really love them for certain things. But that said, MCU, like, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, I have not followed along except for, like, the very biggest releases. So when this came out, I didn't catch it right away. I didn't prioritize it. It came out in December. I didn't catch it until March. So I think it had already exited the theaters and then come back in the ramp up to its Oscar run.
Yes.
So I caught it in an IMAX showing in March of 2019, and I was instantly enamored with it. I was amazed at how, you know, emotional it got me in a couple of spots, namely in like the beginning after the death of Peter, and then on the other side of that, how much it made me laugh because of how unique both the filmmaking and the humor within it are. And then as a fan of New Girl, I don't know if you've ever watched New Girl, Eric, but I really love Jake Johnson in this as Peter B. Parker. Like, it was great to hear a familiar voice from that show in this, especially since it's only been very recently where I feel like he's kind of broken out into a little bit of a wider audience recognition. But then I also just really loved getting to know a new Spider-Man in Miles. Yes, I like all the Spider-Man movies we've gotten, but it wasn't until this one that we got an actual different one. Like, you can say Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man is different than Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man, which is absolutely true, and then Tom Holland's different from them. But hey, they're all Peter Parker. They all have an Aunt May and Uncle Ben. Like, it's more of the same, just told a little bit differently. Miles Morales is different, and I really loved having that perspective because I've never really been a comics person, right? Like, I haven't explored Miles Morales or other versions of Spider-Man myself in the comics. I think I've read some of the original 60s ones, but that's kind of all of my exposure to that as far as comics goes. And then I mentioned the music just a little bit earlier, and we'll still talk about it more later as we do. But I was shocked and still am that Daniel Pemberton didn't get an Oscar nomination for this score, and he didn't get one for Across the Spider-Verse either. Ugh. And his score is so innovative here and so effective in what it's trying to do and how it connects us to the characters. So those are kind of my initial thoughts. I went to my original Letterboxd review and just kind of spewed some of the points.
Hey, listen,
I put in Letterboxd.
Yeah, if you can.
Yeah, yeah. So diving into some story, some just like general filmmaking aspects of the movie, I love what you mentioned. It pays homage and kind of lampoons previous Spider-Man films. They used actual archival recordings of Cliff Robertson's Uncle Ben from the original Spider-Man trilogy. They tease the Spider-Man 3 dance scene. They show us the Spidey and MJ kiss in Spider-Man the original. But then it changes our expectations, because from those other properties, we had an idea of what Green Goblin was and how he would be presented to us. We had an idea of who Dr. Octavius was. And they completely, like, that was a huge surprise the first time I watched. And then the different Peters, having them be presented differently and having different aspects of their life highlighted, or different amounts of experience and life stages. It's really cool how they took our expectations and really threw them aside. And I think that's something that comes a lot from Lord and Miller, to be honest.
I will say too that something I was thinking about when you were talking, Chelsea, is how every Spider-Man movie before kind of in a way made you choose, especially with the sequels, because the Andrew Garfield movies are wonderful, but it kind of pits you in this mode, like, do I like Andrew Garfield as Spider-Man, or do I like Tobey Maguire as Spider-Man, or do I like, and when the MCU came on, I was like, do I like Tom Holland as Spider-Man? I can't choose. Mm-hmm. And then, as you're saying, they all have Uncle Ben's, they all have Aunt May's. It's like, which Aunt May is my favorite? And it's like, at this point, you're just discussing the most minuscule, crazy, like, little differences, and they would all blend together. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was the first Spider-Man that came out and said, you don't have to choose. You can love multiple things. And I think that the message resonated so well. And of course, with the legal disputes being resolved between Sony and Marvel, that they then were able to do basically a live action version of Into the Spider-Verse in No Way Home. And so I think that without Into the Spider-Verse, you also, like, if we think about impact real quick, wouldn't be able to have the level of brand awareness and also the level of synergy between all of the different versions and properties. And just the idea that in the first opening 5 minutes of this film, you have where it's like, you know, just totally that all happened. Yep. Mm-hmm. And here we go. And it's just a wonderful light tone to take. But the film also doesn't shy away from those sadder moments, and so it immediately comes in, embraces everything that has come before, said, hey, if you like that, that's okay, we're going to joke about it a little bit, but it's okay, it's protected, and telling a different story with Miles. We're not trying to tell the same story, to your point, and, you know, we're going to do something different, and we're gonna go on a journey. And it's just like everything everything that the film is made to be is a journey that you sit down, you buckle up, and you ride it. And it's a roller coaster ride of a film. It just, the pacing is fantastic. I don't think there's 30 seconds of this movie that don't look gorgeous. Like, any 30 seconds you take it apart and be like, this alone stands above not just regular live action films, but animated films. There's just nobody doing the kind of work that exists here on the mainstream, you know, like silver screen.
Yeah, that's something I was going to go into just next to talk about briefly, because, I mean, obviously the praises of this film have been sung over and over again as far as its animation style goes, because nobody had done this before. And really, nobody has done this since, except for them with Across the Spider-Verse, when they took the same stuff and topped it even more. Like, it's incredible how they have developed new animation techniques and how they've changed our perspective of what an animated film can look like. The way they take the comics style, whether it's the art or the kind of dots, I don't know the technical term
like
for that.
Word bubbles and various.
Yeah. the way that some things are out of focus, where there's like different layers of the same character stacked just slightly off from each other so that you can tell that that's supposed to be blurred. And so my focus is somewhere else on the screen. It's so cool. And then there's so many fantastic like Easter eggs and blink and you'll miss it moments. Or even frankly, there's things that you will not see if you don't take the movie and go frame by frame through something. So maybe something worthwhile. I think I've seen it. There's probably a Twitter account out there that is like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse frame by frame.
Easter
and
eggs.
I think that would be a fantastic Twitter account to follow because there's so many things that if you don't pause and go like frame, you're just not going to catch it.
Well, and something else that occurs to me, you know, we're still talking about and singing the praises of how good visually this is and how mm-hmm. deep and interesting visually it is. Comics are a visual medium, and yet somehow this feels like the first Spider-Man movie to embrace it. And it's wild because, you know, I loved Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi film with Tobey Maguire, and I thought his costume looked amazing. And I thought that film and the poster, especially, super iconic, really great design. Mm-hmm. It still doesn't feel 10% as visual as this movie does. I mean, maybe that's just animation, but mm-hmm. no, they make it pop. And also they're able to embrace the original medium in a way that the other live action films couldn't by putting in comic panels and showing you, you know, in rapid succession, kind of you read the movie the same way you would read a comic book. And that is just so dynamic and so exciting and interesting that had not been done with any of the comic book movies. And not for lack of trying. They kept turning out comic book movies, you know, since the early 2000s as fast as they possibly mm-hmm. could on every single property. Punisher multiple times. I mean, we don't need to go on the whole list. But, like, I just think that this movie is so brilliant in what it does. And it's so deft at doing it.
Yeah, one other way I will say in which this movie is so brilliant is in regards to just like the feelings it makes me feel while watching. Like, I love all the Spider-Man movies. And if I sat down and watched the Raimi trilogy right now, there would be multiple points through every single one of those films where I would cry. Mm-hmm. Generally, I cry a lot more now anyways. That's just a whole other thing. But I've never been shy about my emotions anyways. Those movies make me cry. There's specific things. But one thing that the Spider-Man video game on PS4 showed me was how much I could care about like an Aunt May. And to all those films' credits, they do amazing things, but I don't know if I ever loved Aunt May the way I do in that specific Spider-Man game. And there's not like a ton of Aunt May here. We get a little bit of her and she's great. But my point is, the connection I have to certain characters and the feelings I feel in this are things that the game had been the only other Spider-Man property to really make me feel in a long time, because the MCU films, they don't make me feel emotions the same way in the Amazing Spider-Man or the original Spider-Man trilogy until they got to No Way Home, which again, which I think was inspired from both the game and from this film. So it's just amazing what they're able to do with storytelling and how animation is not for kids. Animation is a medium and it can be used to any audience and to build any emotion and any effect. And I love that.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And, you know, I'd also say to your point about reveals and surprises just throughout the story, so much of it is about doing something new and breaking fresh ground, but so much of it is looking back and the subversion of expectations. Like, they hide Dr. Octavius's last name mm-hmm. in science class when Miles walks in for the first time and you're not right. expecting it. When it happens, you're like, oh my God, how did I not see that? Mm-hmm. And so it's really, it manages to be brilliant and in so many ways. It's just smart.
Or the when Aaron is revealed as Prowler, like there was a line at the very beginning of the movie when they go down into the subway station to tag the wall. He says, I found this on an engineering job. But then you turn the corner and there's the super collider. So it's like, where did you really discover this, Aaron? It's just a kind of drop and you miss it line that doesn't make sense until you're watching it for the second or third time.
Absolutely.
So going into characters, we have a brand new Spider-Man, Miles Morales. What do you think about Miles?
What I love about Miles Morales, especially if you're thinking like Peter Parker, and all the films that have come before with Peter Parker. I know he was supposed to be in high school, but I still don't, like, until Tom Holland, at least, mm-hmm. they hadn't really nailed that youthful kind of a look. And certainly, you know, with their choice of casting, which I've always enjoyed, you never really got the sense that he was actually a high schooler. Like, I think to your point too, like, the Marvel video game is pretty good at getting, like, a younger version, but even he's, like, early college age, mm-hmm. if I'm remembering correctly. And so Miles is young. Miles is in, you know, secondary school, middle school, actually. I think it's called it a couple of times. So you're really put up front with what makes any Spider-Man very, very, very fun is his youth mm-hmm. and quips and the ability to kind of handle the situation while juggling all the things of a teenager. And so that, to me, is what stands out immediately about Miles, is just how young he is and how they managed to go even younger than, like, what Peter was. And, of course, most of this film centers around, like, a middle-aged Peter Parker mm-hmm. in Peter B. Parker. And so I think that you just Miles is such a breath of fresh air in multiple regions, and also just his age is so refreshing and wonderful. And you remember what it was like to have to write that assignment, you know, what are my expectations? What do I want to be when I grow up? And it just, the film has a really lovely way of putting you into kind of that aspect of youth, and I think immediately endears you to the character that you ordinarily wouldn't know a lot about. I don't know much about folks from Brooklyn, and I don't know much about artists and anyone who can do half the things that he can do so skilled and amazingly, but it just, the film holds your hand through it and just shows you that this is a great kid who I also mentioned, speaking of characters, a number of our movies we've discussed have a strained parental relationship, a paternal strained relationship with the protagonist of the movie. this movie's we've done it again, yeah. Chelsea, we've done it again. But yeah, we, you know, everything there is special, and I think this actually came out, so 2018, probably the same year as Marvel's Spider-Man game. Actually, they were both 2018 releases. Yeah. And I did confuse sort of how what happens to Miles's dad mm-hmm. In the game versus what happens in this movie. And so I'm so relieved, I think, either both times or definitely this time, that, oh yeah, Miles's dad is like in the sequel. Mm-hmm. Just like, that's not a thing with the Marvel's video game series, except in certain instances. So it's just wonderful to see how, again, this manages to differentiate itself in so many ways.
Yeah, I first want to just briefly shout out the representation. Like, this is a kid with a Black father and a Hispanic mother. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And they didn't invent this for the film. It came from the comics. That's how Miles has always been represented, as far as I'm aware. But it's important to point out, because kids need to see themselves on screen. So I don't think we need to spend a ton of more time on that, but I think it's really important. You have to acknowledge the representation here. But me, as a white person living down in Texas, not up in New York, I can identify with so many of the struggles that Miles is going through. They have such a unique twist on the "with great power comes great responsibility" trope in here. In fact, they even make fun of that quote when his father botches it on the way to school at the beginning
of
the movie.
Don't finish that sentence.
Yeah. Yeah, and then Peter B. Parker, absolutely, as well. At the beginning of the movie, he feels so many expectations coming at him from different directions. The first we see it is from his father. He says, "You're a grown man now. Let's show your teachers that." He's 16 years old, right? Like, he's 16 years old. His dad's expectation of what a young man should be doing are thrust upon him, about what kind of person Miles should be, about what responsibility he should have. And you love your parents through that, but Miles just, you have a hard time connecting with it, right? Like, you have a hard time connecting with them. And when he gets to school and he gets a zero on the true or false quiz, which means he knew all the answers and selected the wrong ones.
It's so clever. Yeah. It's such a good way. Yeah.
His teacher says, "You're trying to quit and I'm not going to let you." He's at the school that he doesn't want to be a part of. He left a school and his friends behind to go to this new school that his parents think are better for him. And it might be, but it's not what he wants, at least not in this moment. And so there's a stifling of who Miles wants to be. And still, even though that's what Miles wants, everybody else is prioritizing the opportunities this would afford him, right?
Yeah.
But the exception of that is when he meets with Uncle Aaron the first time. And while they're graffitiing down in the subway, which is something that was encouraged by Aaron in the first place, he says the real Miles came out of hiding. So Miles, when he is finally able to express himself the way he wants to, is able to relieve himself of some of that pressure that is being thrust on him from all these sources.
Yeah, to channel all of these emotions into a creative outlet is so crucial for all of us at all stages in our life, but especially Miles, who's so talented, has all this potential, but you get sick of hearing how much your potential, you know, is, and you just kind of want that creative outlet. You want that ability to show it in a way you want to show it. Mm-hmm. And so that's very much why Aaron, as an outlet, you know, Uncle Aaron is just fantastic for Miles. And I do love, you know, their character dynamic in particular. And even before he gets to school in the morning, one of the things that brought, that I just remembered, that really brings me into being that age, which is, you know, 16, is his father forcing him to say I love you back and mm-hmm. have it be so embarrassing, right? Like, a parent's love is so embarrassing. But, you know, I'm quite a bit older than 16 now, and I'm like, oh God, what a lovely thing for a kid to have, is their parents' love like that, right? You know, and so it's funny because you having lived, you know, and then sort of grown and matured too, you can see both sides. It's like, oh, as a parent, I would have loved to, you know, you really appreciate what Miles's father is doing.
I agree. And then with all of that pressure that is coming from around him, how much greater is that pressure when he gets spider powers and then Spider-Man dies and he's like, like,
yeah.
Can you imagine what that must feel like? He watched Spider-Man get killed. Spider-Man's been taking care of New York City. He's been absolutely living large. Like, he's doing well for himself. He's got MJ. He's got all the merchandise. He's happy to be Spider-Man, or at least that's the way it's presented. There's a couple of lines that suggest that maybe he's heading down toward the Peter B. Parker route. But I can't imagine what Miles feels like knowing that he feels like he has to step into this role, right? Spider-Man, Peter Parker tells him, it looks like you don't have a choice, kid. Like, this happened to you and you have this responsibility now. And now there's a deadline because Kingpin might blow up New York. Yeah. And he doesn't know what he's doing. And having comic books as your guide is a poor substitute for having an actual mentor. So I just can't imagine how overwhelming all of that pressure, on top of the pressure from your family to be someone that you're not really seeing yourself turning into, must feel like.
And the idea that you wouldn't have time for your mentor, whoever that may be, to really inspire you, that life is precious, they're taken away. Not to mention just how wild it is that Spider-Man is murdered on screen by a supervillain. And this movie, like, is just getting started. Mm-hmm. And they've killed Peter Parker.
Yeah, that's the scene that gets me crying the first time in this movie, because I imagine Miles's pressure on himself and the responsibility he feels in that moment. But I also imagine the citizens of New York who have gotten used to feeling safe with somebody like Spider-Man on the streets, taking care of them for the last decade, and seeing, yeah, maybe he invites these supernatural, like this giant Green Goblin creature around every once in a while, but then he stops them, right? So I can't imagine what it would feel like. Like, what happens next? Like, what's going to happen to New York now that we don't have our protector?
That's the shocking thing. I must admit, I had that same thought going through, is like, what are the people of New York thinking right now?
Mm-hmm.
Just the idea that he's unmasked when he's killed too, and there's all this opportunity for story, but it's just like collective mourning and what to do now. You know, ultimately the film is about not feeling alone and not having to face any insurmountable challenges alone. But we all can't necessarily wait for a multidimensional portal to open up and several versions of ourselves or are their counterparts to come through the rift. That said, it still manages to be a great tale of learning yourself, reflection, and kind of realizing your true potential. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a potential that others tell you you have, but, you know, part of the growth process and part of the maturity process that I think Miles is going through have him have to sit out and not be a part of the main action for just a moment longer so that he can really get his bearings and come into, you know, his role. And so it's a wonderful arc kind of that goes through all the characters and all the narratives.
Well, there's also a difference between saying you have this potential, now I'm going to tell you what you need to do with it, and then saying, you have this potential. I can't wait to see what you do with it, which is the flip that his father makes, right? In the end, it's encouragement from everybody else that helps Miles to crack the code to being Spidey. When Uncle Aaron is unmasked as the Prowler and makes the decision to not fulfill Kingpin's order and kill his nephew, he says, you're the best of us, Miles. Keep going. Like, I messed up. I made the mistake here because I wanted to be a role model for you, and I have failed in that role. But still, here you are being the best of us. Keep going. Keep doing that. And then when the other spider people are going to the Collider and they decide that Miles can't go with him because he's not ready, Peter says, you've just got to take a leap of faith. You're not going to know you're ready, but put some trust in yourself. Take a leap of faith. When you are ready to take the leap, you are ready, right? And then when his father comes while he's tied up, he says, you have this spark and it's amazing and I can't wait to see what you're going to do with it, but it's yours. And he says, I love you, but you don't have to say it back. So it's when everybody kind of realizes that they need to get out of Miles' way in him becoming who he wants to be, who he's meant to be, however you want to phrase that. They have to get out of his way so that he can do it his way in his own style. And that's when we get the amazing Spider-Man suit, and we get the, not the amazing Spider-Man suit, the Spider-Man suit.
That is amazing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The wonderful Spider-Man suit.
Yeah.
Badass, cool looking Spider-Man suit. You had to really say amazing, didn't you?
It was completely unintentional. And then in the moment, I was like, wait a second, that's something else.
Thing. Yeah, you're going to get people writing in going, actually, the amazing Spider-Man suit is this one. Right. But actually, speaking of other Spider-Man, so we've spent this whole time wonderful talking about the story, but one of the film's strong suits is these other Spideys, is these other alternatives, including Spider-Gwen, you know, a version of Gwen Stacy, Peter Porker, a.k.a. Spider-Pig, Spider-Pig. You know, I just feel like this film was so self-aware at what had come before, and there's moments of characterizations that it's not just like the writers thought, wouldn't this be fun, but really they seem to have tapped into like a really well thought out, like, you know, zeitgeisty kind of thing of like, I wonder if Spider-Man could be this, and it's like, let's see if that happens. Like, Spider-Man is a 1930s era detective, you know, like, it just is so unbelievable. So I would say that every Spider-Man in this film, it's like the writers committed to the bit. They had an idea and they run with it 100%. It does not let up. The characterization of each and every one of these other Spider-Men, whatever their deal is, these Spider-Persons, it's consistent, and they don't let up on the joke, on what makes them funny, and they don't let up on shying away from emotions, which makes them great and human. And it just really feels like, you know, for an ensemble cast, there's nobody that falls by the wayside, and there's still just so much to love in every single split frame moment that we get with all of these Spideys.
Yeah, their reveal, well, we get both Peter B. and Spider-Woman, Spider-Gwen, before we get the reveal of the other three, but their reveal in the spider lair behind or underneath Aunt May's house is so cool when they turn around and out of the darkness comes the three, Spider-Man Noir, Peter Porker, or Spider-Pig, and I'm trying to think of what her, Penny's actual, like, spider name is. I've got it right here. It's SP/DR. It's like a tech SP/DR. So it's like spider.
Yeah, I thought it was the year, like 31 something's like Spider-Man 30. It would be, yeah, SP/DR.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So I mean, and to their credit, I think they just found these like already existing spider people, like in the comics universe at least. Like maybe they were one-offs or whatever, but to bring them all together and to have them be their own unique thing and have their own unique physics is all really cool. But then we get some fantastic characters in like Peter B. Parker, right? I love how in contrast he is to this universe's Peter. Chris Pine's Spider-Man was younger by about 12 years. He's still married to Mary Jane. He's generally more put together. Johnson is older. He's weary. He's somewhat jaded. He's almost doing the Spidey thing as a coping mechanism at this point, as he's dealing with living alone and having separated from MJ. And I hinted at this earlier. I do want us to mention that there almost seems to be a hint of weariness to both of the Peters we get in this film. Because during that fight against the Green Goblin, before he's killed, Chris Pine's Peter says, I'm so tired during the fight. And then after the Collider falls and he's kind of lying in the rubble, he says, yeah, I always get up. like weird, like he's tired with it. He's like, it's just what's expected of me. I always get up, and then he's killed. So I almost sense that he was an earlier version of Peter B, like continuing on this trajectory of like completely wearing himself out. Who knows what that would have led him to had Kingpin not killed him in this instance.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, and I think it's really interesting that you point that out. And that's one of the things that always works, I think, about Spider-Man more than other superheroes. They're able to be shown to be more vulnerable. Part of his youth is what makes him vulnerable, but the other thing that makes him vulnerable is being tired, showing that he, you know, oh, I always get up. Like, you know, like exactly what you're saying, like Peter Parker, the Chris Pine version, is still pretty young, as you said, but is still showing those signs of weariness. And you get the sense that it would be very good for him if he took a vacation and also had Miles to watch the city while he was gone.
Absolutely.
And, you know, this version, there, you know, there was presumably not a Miles Morales, certainly not bitten by a spider in Peter B. Parker's version or universe, but you kind of have, again, it's playing with your expectations of, you know, Peter will mentor Miles and that'll be wonderful. And then it doesn't happen. And you're like, oh my God. But showing Peter as tired, exhausted, really put upon shows what a toll that doing all this superhero stuff takes. And, you know, it is something else because in comic books and cartoons and things, Spider-Man can be perpetually young and never age or never feel tired. And that's not at all the approach. There's no Spider-Man in this movie that is perpetually any one way, except maybe the pig, because he's a cartoon. But even he has some character growth, I would argue, voiced by John Mulaney. So yeah, it's just wild to show that even in the versions of Peter Parker that they're showing in this movie, they're all different and they all have something different to offer than any of the other Peter Parkers we've seen.
Yeah, I think Peter B being 12 years further along and him having had life happen to him basically in not the most positive of ways is an argument, or can be an argument, for not trying to do everything by yourself and creating partnerships and trusting others, which is what we see throughout this movie as we have all the spider people teaming up. We have at the end Miles deciding to make the connection between him and, well, his roommate, but actually towards his father. Like, this is a partnership that I look forward for us working together. We get this quote from Peter B where he says, "Most people I meet in the workplace are trying to kill me, so you're a nice change of pace." Yeah. So it's nice that he's able to grow from having Miles as not a mentor, like he's kind of supposed to be the mentor, even though he's not necessarily the best one in some senses. But at least he's not presented as incompetent, right?
Yeah.
He knows the ropes very well, like in the rafters or in the AC unit of the lab. He says, "These are typical Spider-Man stakes." Next, he's going to say, "You have 44 hours. And then he says that. He's like, "Hey, I know how this works," right? He just has to learn to work with others and how to be a teacher, right? Like, that's something that he has to learn how to do. And it almost helps him to be a better Spider-Man himself because he has to sit back and kind of like, okay, how did I do that? Okay, I do this, and then I do this. Aim with your hips, double tap. Like, he has to break down his process that has become old hat for him, and that helps him be better. And that, to be honest, that's something that has helped me as a teacher, is teaching helps me be better at the thing that I'm teaching about.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, the only other thing I'd say with that is that it's revealed that Peter B. Parker falling out with Mary Jane happened over her wanting children. And not two things of note that I want to bring up is, one, he said that scared him. He tells Miles, "That scared me, and so that's why the relationship didn't work out." And just that acknowledgement, "That scares me," seeing a grown adult male admit to being scared is so great in media. But it also shows that the superheroes get scared, that there's moments of personal vulnerability. And, you know, the other thing is that Spider-Man from Sam Raimi version had to put Mary Jane at arm's length in that movie because those close to him would always be, you know, more at risk or whatever. And there is that, but we still need each other. We still need other people to make us better, to help us through, you know, life's things. And why not have that level of outreach? So I think that's, I love that you're focusing on kind of like in what ways the presence of Miles is such a good influence on Peter B. Parker. And I think, too, you know, that teaching him the ropes and things, like, could one day make Peter B. Parker a great dad.
Well, he even has that quote where he says, "Oh, I'm so proud of you. Do I want kids?"
Right? I missed that line. I love that quote. I didn't even hear
it. Oh, it's so good. Yeah, you need to rewatch now and listen to that line. It's great.
Oh, it's so good.
So I don't really have much else to say about Peter B. Do you?
No, except that, you know, there's a lot of references to Peter B. Parker's waistline. And I have to say, being mid-30s and watching sort of the belly develop and kind of, you know, he may not be a father yet, but having the dad bod, it's a good source for humor for Peter B., you know, yeah, I'm out of shape. Like, think about, he must still get so much more exercise than most people because he's, you know, always out and about and swinging and everything. Mm-hmm. But some things are just a little unavoidable or a little less avoidable than others. So I liked, again, that this Peter Parker, while older, did not have all the invulnerability and, like, you know, the perfect chiseled athletic spider look to him. So I appreciate it also from a body diversity standpoint that we were allowed to have a dad bod Spider-Man.
Yeah, and that Miles didn't call him fat. He says, and why is your body a different shape?
Yeah, it was so sidestepped in a endearing way.
Yeah. So moving on to Gwen, what do you have to say about her?
I mean, honestly, the version of Gwen that we get in Into the Spider-Verse and its immediate sequel, voiced by Hailee Steinfeld, makes me want to consume every edition of Spider-Gwen, everything that there has ever been. And I haven't yet, but as a character who is so emotionally intelligent and able to be, you know, a good friend, even while not wanting friendship necessarily, to Miles as she is in this film, it's a beautiful change of pace. And again, you know, a universe where Gwen Stacy saw her version of Peter die and had to take the mantle on herself. And there's a lot to love in Gwen's strength and her physical prowess, her ability to be the spider person for her universe. And she's been doing it like 2 years by the time we meet her, which means she started when she was really young, like maybe 14 or 15. So, yeah, there's a lot to love about the Spider-Gwen character, and definitely this version, not to mention the costume, is so striking and so wonderful looking with cool hood. I just love everything about it.
Yeah, the way that she first appears as Spider-Woman is one of the coolest scenes in the movie, with the rock music and the soundtrack going, and Peter and Miles get webbed in the trees, and then Olivia gets kicked in the face. Like, it's so cool.
Yeah, well, and before then, she has to pretend not to be aware of things when Miles gets literally stuck to her, you know, and there's so many other funny moments, but, like, the idea that, like, part of her badass undercut happens because literally Miles is, like, stuck to her hair. They have to cut off the side of it. They have to shave, you know, the side of her head to get the two of them physically separated. The idea that she takes that, you know, so coolly while undercover and then is like, no, you don't get to like this hair later, you know, is like, you did this to me. It just, you know, there's nothing jokey about it. It's all just kind of like she has the intelligence and the wit and the ability to know when certain information needs to be divulged.
There's additional conversation to be had about Gwen that's presented in Across the Spider-Verse that I don't necessarily want to tie in here, but maybe one day we'll do the sequel.
I would love to.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's very applicable.
What are you doing next week?
We'll see. But like Peter B., she's been going at the Spider-Man thing alone or Spider-Woman thing alone for a while, and she's been doing it as a way to protect herself. And, man, that just wears you down. I can't imagine the heartbreak of losing Peter as her best friend in her universe in a tragic way that is revealed in the next movie, by the way, if you haven't seen it yet. And then amidst that, working alongside a different version of him in this universe and never bringing it up.
Never. Not once.
No. Yeah. And I mean, there's even that scene late in the film where they're trying to work their way down to the collider through the cocktail party that's happening. And Peter B. is trying to connect with MJ here because he's lost his MJ. And then she says, she is not your MJ. Believe me, buddy, I've been through this, right? And here she is with Peter, maybe a little bit older than the Peter she lost, but it's still Peter. I can't imagine what it must be like for that. And honestly, I mean, it just shows a maturity that Fisk is incapable of exercising because he can't distinguish between different versions of, like, his wife and kids. And I just realized I didn't really take a lot of notes on Fisk, but that is a lack of emotional maturity in trying to, it's almost like what happened to Wanda in WandaVision, right? Like, she tried to create this version of things that is, it wasn't real. And then was it the Doctor Strange movie?
Doctor Strange Madness,
Multiverse of Madness, where she tried to take another Wanda's kids or something like that. you can't do that, right? Like, they belong to a different universe, to different people, and they have their own connections that you would be ripping them apart from. And then who knows what the Fisk in that universe is going
to
do,
well,
right?
Well, that's, yeah, hell, he's going to build a collider over there to get him back.
Yeah, and so here is Gwen having lost her best friend. She's completely closed herself off from making connections with other people until this very instance. And even then, she's cagey about it. And she's working with alongside of Peter, and she's not telling him a single bit of what she's been through regarding him specifically.
It's amazing. And it's absolutely amazing maturity for her to have had those same kind of life things. And, you know, I, as far as Fisk, the thing that I thought was closest in his characterization was actually his version played by Vincent D'Onofrio in the Daredevil TV series. Very mm-hmm. similar kind of trajectory in that he is driven to physical violence. He's a big man who is very strong, not quite so big as he is in this animated version, but actually pretty domineering. And the idea that he can love, but it comes hard, and the idea that if that person were to ever see the kingpin, the actual criminal element of him, they would be terrified and run screaming. It's exactly what happens to Wilson Fisk's wife and kid here. His wife takes the kid out of the house because it's obviously not safe for them, and that's her read of it. Mm-hmm. That being Fisk's tragic kind of impetus, you know, they get in a car accident, he's not able to rectify things, really makes him such a tragic figure. And so another prop to this film as a whole is that its villains, so to speak, except for Green Goblin, don't know what his deal is, are all sympathetic.
The main ones, at least, yes.
Yeah, they're all sympathetic. And, yeah. And you know, I just love that about it. And you can sympathize with the need to, okay, if multiple universes exist, then there's one where I haven't lost them, I can go get them. That's his drive. You get it.
Do you think, moving into another character, do you think his Miles's father, Jefferson, knew about Fisk's criminal activities prior to the climax of this film?
I think it would maybe be impossible to say specifically, because on the one hand, it's New York. You always assume that, you know, especially like nicknames like Kingpin would have probably gotten out alongside his name. Now I'm kind of being taken to like an actual live action Daredevil version of like the city where, if you know, is like Wilson Fisk is not all clean. Yeah. There's skeletons in that closet. But as far as the extent of it, you know, like I didn't get the impression that Jefferson Davis was very crooked or in any way overlooking the criminal element of Kingpin, but he's very adept at, I think, going where he's needed and sticking his nose out of other things. Like it seems like Miles's father has a spidey sense of his own as far as when to toe the line, when to not go extra. And he's not quite that cop that's going to go to the ends of the earth to make any wrongdoers go away. I think that he has a smart sense about what is and isn't worth investigating. Somehow that's just the impression I get.
I tended to think that he had at least some inkling of Fisk's criminal activities, just because, well, I guess walking upon the collider at the end of the movie and seeing all the chaos that's happening, and then the large man is chasing the small spider and trying to like very obviously kill him, it's easy to kind of like change your allegiance and root for Spider-Man. But I just had a little bit of a sense that maybe it's similar to, I think, like in the Nolan or just in the Batman universe, Carmine Falcone was the lead of like this criminal enterprise and everybody knows it. But because he controls so many hands of the local government with his money, then it's like, what can we do about it? That was kind of my impression. But either way, talking a little bit more about Jefferson, we already talked about kind of his relationship with Miles, but I think what's interesting to explore first here is his relationship with his brother.
Yeah.
He makes sort of a snide comment about Uncle Aaron at the beginning of the movie, and Miles says, "What's wrong with Uncle Aaron? He's a good guy." And so we see that in some respect, Jefferson is protecting Miles from the truth. I'm sure that he doesn't know his Prowler connection. I think that's probably a surprise for him when he comes across his body wearing the Prowler suit in the alleyway. But I would bet there's a history of some kind of criminal activity behind Aaron that would cause this rift between them, as Jefferson pursued a career in law enforcement and then Aaron took this alternate route.
Yeah, and you know, for such a movie that does so many things and focuses on so many characters, it's amazing that the relationship between Aaron and Jefferson feels lived in and feels real. These are two brothers that feel like brothers, and you can tell that they were used to be close and they've grown apart. And these moments where, you know, Jefferson has to call Aaron and leave a message asking if he's seen Miles and says, you know, I wouldn't ask if it wasn't important, is literally like just that. He knows he wouldn't ask unless it's important. Like, they don't have this tight relationship despite being brothers, and yet both of them in different ways are good for Miles. And you mentioned at the beginning of the film when Miles hangs out with Aaron, but that's exactly what Miles needs in that moment. I think Jefferson is keenly aware of that as well, that Miles didn't need a father. He needed an uncle at the beginning of the film. And so it just works on, I think, many levels. And I do think he was surprised to find, you know, his brother in the prowler suit. But I also think that what could have been a really cloying moment of him blaming Spider-Man for his brother's death because he sees them in the alley together doesn't go so hard at that because of the reveal that his brother is also the prowler. So it's like, okay, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. I could blame Spider-Man for my brother, but if my brother wasn't doing the law-abiding stuff, then also what, you know, that complicates things more. And I just think that all of the characterization is superb, and it's able to be, it just feels lived in.
I don't think he blames, well, he does put out an APB when he comes across Miles leaving Aaron's body in the alley, right? Like, and at the end of the movie, he says, well, I thought I knew who killed Aaron, but I was wrong. So obviously there was a point where he thought that Spider-Man was the one, or like Miles specifically was the one who killed Aaron. He just didn't have the whole Prowler story necessarily at that time. But that moment sort of sparks a reinvigorated hatred for Spidey, because he was already against Spider-Man, right? Like, he didn't like Peter Parker, Spider-Man. He made that pretty clear from the beginning of the movie. He doesn't like the whole vigilante lifestyle, but that turns from like, I wish this guy wouldn't do this thing. We're the ones out there doing the actual work without masks on, right? But when Spider-Man presumably kills Aaron, there's this like, okay, we got to take care of the spider problem. But then as he's watching this collision between Kingpin and Miles in the super collider, I think he has this newfound respect for Spider-Man and a new appreciation for his brother, maybe, amidst all of this as well. We see the invite to Miles to come graffiti a wall legally at the police station, and he does a rest in power memorial for his uncle despite his criminal activities. Maybe it's never fully revealed exactly the lengths to which he went, but by the end of the movie, Jefferson has an appreciation for closeness between family and respecting others' decisions to protect that closeness.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
And acknowledging that encouragement is better than enforcement when it comes to family, at least in this instance. As parents, there are things where you have to enforce things for your children, but like dictating all of their choices and like who their friends are and all that kind of stuff, that's not the place to do it.
No, this film is just rife with good male vulnerability.
There's one more character to talk about. We don't have to spend too much time on him, though. Do you have much to say about Aaron specifically?
The biggest thing for Aaron, apart from him being exactly what Miles needs, sort of, you know, the steady hand of an older male without sort of the domineering concerns of his father wanting the best for him and wanting to like be responsible for the best things to happen to Miles. That line, "I wanted to be a role model for you," really speaks to, yes, we may go wayward, we as in all of us, collective we, but even, you know, a character like that, you're like, oh, he's a villain. He's working with the literally worst villains to do things that would bring about the end of the universe, or at least, you know, really mess up some other parallel worlds. Still, to have the, you know, the intentions be of some moral footing or some idea, you know, it's unclear what would have been or you know, when the Prowler's identity would have been revealed. But the idea of, I want to be a role model, and having that get wayward and sidetracked and end up just being a mercenary for, you know, the big Kingpin, it speaks to, I think, how anybody can get roped into sort of a nefarious plan with good intentions.
Yeah, we don't know the circumstances that brought Aaron to Kingpin and to become the Prowler, but to his credit, when the time comes to show love to Miles, he does what's most important. There is a brief moment where as he's got Miles dangling over the side of the house and it's revealed that, oh, this spider kid is my nephew, he lowers the mask on Miles.
Oh.
And you don't know for a second, are you going to, like, is this to desensitize yourself from killing your nephew, like Kingpin is asking you to do? Or is this, hey, I acknowledge the importance of wearing a mask, right? Like protecting the people you love, protecting your identity. And it does end up being that latter one. And then we already talked through that heartbreaking scene in the alley where he says, you're the best of all of us and that you're on your way. Just keep going. So I love that in a way, Aaron, he's the villain in one respect, in a small respect, because Fisk is the ultimate bad guy. But when it matters for him to do the right thing and be the person that Miles needs him to be, he steps up and he does that. The only character I had left on my list, unless you wanted to mention any, was May. And I love that she's like a cross between the May of the Spider-Man game on PlayStation and Alfred from Batman, right? Like, she's this combination of gentle lady doing good in the world and here's a cave, let me build us some spider shooters for you, right? Like, it's so cool.
She's great. She serves a purpose. She has a lot of humor. You didn't think you were the only ones who'd think to show up here, did you? You know, it's very serviceable. And the ability for her to get close to Peter B. Parker, right? Because mm-hmm. the people who did show up before these guys did to enter the lair and she showed them down were not as close looking to her actual nephew as Peter B. Parker is. Mm-hmm. And the level of familiarity that is expressed between the two of them when they're still standing in her front lawn having just hit the doorbell is really, that's when my heart tugged deeply, because she knows enough to know that this is not her Peter, but the parts of him that are identical and similar to her Peter are still there. And it must be so much like what Gwen is going through in seeing your best friend, your old best friend, or, you know, a shadow of them essentially on a new or a living person's face. And a lot of that is just shown and is very delicately handled in small moments in between dialogue.
Yeah, that's definitely a great tearjerker moment, because here you have Aunt May who has lost her Peter, and then you have Peter who has lost his Aunt May, and the two of them find each other, and they both know that they can't necessarily be the same role for the other person that the other person filled, but there's still an acknowledgement that, oh, you have the face of this person that I loved, and we can share that grief together in a way, and we can also provide some comfort for each other. And I really love that.
Yeah.
I also love, just one last thing on her, the little brief amount of history that's hinted at when Octavius, Dr. Otto, however you want to say it, shows up at her house and she goes, oh great, it's Liv, because we found out at the lab that only her friends call her Liv. So what is the history between Dr. Octavius and Aunt May, right?
There is a novelization to be written that goes into all of that, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, I didn't even catch that. I mean, following the Amazing Spider-Man, the Andrew Garfield movies, version of events with Peter's dad being with the government and you know, a scientist mm-hmm. working alongside Norman Osborn, you know, like, a lot of that's really interesting. Maybe that's May in this, you know, it could be.
Yeah, just interesting thing to consider.
There was one more character I wanted to mention, and I feel like I haven't done enough to him, but Spider-Man Noir, and, you know, voiced by Nicolas Cage. I have to say, I did not have really any impression of Spider-Man Noir the first time watching this film. I thought it was fun. It's fun they got Nicolas Cage for it. But maybe another thing to be said is, like, watching this movie with headphones, because the sound can be a bit all over the place, which, you know, we'll talk about next, but something about the deadpan delivery of the dialogue and the way that Spider-Man Noir is able to be shown as having real emotion. You know, he's not strictly your hard-boiled detective. He's able to, like, marvel at a Rubik's Cube, and a Rubik's Cube, which I totally missed the first time around. He then takes back to the noir universe and is some kind of, has like an exhibit about color in this whole thing. So yeah, the idea that you would, you know, exploit other universes for personal gain, it just shows you that that Peter is not as distant or different than maybe what we first thought of him. And for me, all the jokes land. There's one moment where they're talking about who's died close to them. And, you know, Gwen says for me, it was Peter. And Peter says it was my Uncle Ben. And then Spider-Man Noir says it was my Uncle Benjamin. It's just, you know, the formal version of Ben is just, it's so funny. It's so, again, commitment to the bit, commitment to the world. It made me laugh.
Yeah, I really like him. And the way he comforts Penny at the end of the movie before they go back home after she's lost her robot.
I love that so much. Yeah. And yeah, I've seen the sequel, yeah, which is really excellent. But seeing the opportunity to see some of these characters again is something that watching the end of this film, you really would love.
Yeah, I hope we get more of them in the third movie, because we don't get much of the alternate Spider-Man in the sequel to this film. Alternate meaning Penny and Peter Parker and Spider-Man Noir. We just don't get much of them in the sequel. They show up at the end. And so I hope we get more of them again, and even more spider people in Beyond the Spider-Verse when it comes out this year, I think, still is when it's slated. Moving on to music. And I know in the past for the music segment, I have sometimes gone like track by track and mentioned specific moments on the actual soundtrack. And then sometimes I've even had sound clips on my soundboard. When I post those to YouTube, they always get flagged for copyright. And so I'm not going to do that anymore, probably. And this was a specific film that I did not go like track by track through the album. So I don't have those kind of moments to call out, though if you do, I would love it. But I have a bunch of moments and really one specific motif that I wanted to talk about as they appear in the film. So I will do that in a moment, but I would love for you to start. What do you think about the music?
For me, what would be considered the, you know, movie score, you know, movie soundtrack is as much score as it is original or like, you know, actual music too, like music tracks by artists. And for me, it is so seamless. It is impossible for me to tell if something is the actual score of the movie, in this movie in particular, mm-hmm, or if it's like lo-fi, you know, some kind of hip hop or jazz or blues track that has existed. I literally cannot tell the difference. And so I just love how musical the film is as a whole. And I really wouldn't know where to begin trying to separate out tracks, because everything is 100% seamless. You get these licks, and then they go into real songs that are based on the lick, and it's just like, it's unbelievably competent and cohesive the whole way through.
Yeah, I really do like the soundtrack album for this movie, which is the pop songs like Post Malone's Sunflower, etc. There's a lot of good moments that are highlighted in the movie with pop songs. I'm trying to think. Sunflower pops up a few times. I can't name specific songs because I don't actually own the soundtrack album. I own the score album. But the song that plays during the brief montage as we're seeing New York reckoning with Peter Parker being dead and Spider-Man being gone, that's a great song. There's obviously the What's Up Danger sequence, which I will talk about because it's maybe like one of the best shots and one of the best like music moments in film. And I'm trying to think if there's any other standout moments. It's a really good soundtrack.
Yeah, well, definitely the song that Miles uses to relax is the song he's shown in his dorm to be kind of relaxing to. And then when he's, I think, where they're with Octavius's lab and he's trying to like not shake the light, he also has to sing it out loud and dance and reenact it. And it's just a really good use of music. It's just really, it's so wonderful in this film.
Speaking specifically of Pemberton's score, from the very beginning of the movie, we get this ramp up that's very like hip hop, DJ, record scratch infused, in some ways similar to, I think it's Ludwig Göransson who scored the Black Panther Ooh. Film, at least the first one. I think he might have also done the second one. Very hip hop infused, especially whenever Michael B. Jordan's character Killmonger was on screen. Lots of hip hop music. But that idea was so emphasized here in Into the Spider-Verse, and it's featured throughout, and I really love that. We get a ramp up over the opening production logos into the reveal of the comics. What's the CCA stand? I just wrote CCA. I don't remember what that stands for.
Comics Code?
It's like something. Oh, it might be Comics Code Authority.
Yeah.
And then the opening montage / monologue by Peter Parker, the way all that ramps into and flows into each other is so cool. It really sets you up from the beginning to know that the score is different, right? A couple more specific moments, and then I have like a motif that I want to talk about. So there's Gwen's music that I already mentioned as she appears as Spider-Woman as the first time. And then during her montage, it's a lot more like rock and roll kind of themed, or almost like punk music kind of themed, versus the hip hop that we've kind of gotten for Miles so far, which is really cool. The Prowler has his own little motif that's almost like a growl. And the dramatic music reveal when he's revealed to be Aaron as he shows up at his apartment while Miles is trying to write this, like, I need help, I don't know what I'm going through or how to handle it letter. And then when Peter B falls back into the portal at the end of the movie to return home, there's a solo French horn that plays. And I'm a French horn player, so I love it for that. But I also, it reminds me of Raimi's trilogy in that moment, like the music from Danny Elfman's score to the original three Spider-Man movies. I really love it. Anything else you want to say before I go into my slightly longer?
No, I love how we're nerding out about it. I love how you have a good ear for these things, and I'm happy to just be here.
Okay. So it's a motif that I want to call the Great Expectations motif. And it might have a different name if you look at the score album and they label that. I don't know, but I'm calling it the Great Expectations motif. We hear it for the first time, at least the first time I noticed it in film, as Peter, the original Peter, is about to be killed. And he's telling Miles to wear a mask, tell no one who he is, how he doesn't have a choice but to use his powers for good. So as this responsibility is like being handed off from Peter to Miles, we hear this motif for the first time. And it's like, it's kind of brassy. It's like an octave jump. Ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum. And that just kind of repeats, okay, right? So check that out. We hear it again the first time Miles goes out trying to train. We get that awesome joke where he climbs to the top of the tall building and decides it's too tall. So we get the squeaky shoes as he runs back down and he finds a shorter building. Yeah. But then during the moments where he's not climbing stairs, he has that moment where he's like looking out and we hear that motif again. We hear it again when they enter the Spidey cave and he's standing in front of the array of Spider-Man suits and his shoulders are sitting below the shoulders of the Spider-Man suit that he's looking at, right? So again, expectations being thrust on him that he feels like he's having to live up to. We hear it again as Aaron lies dying in the alley, but this time it's almost like it's transforming because Aaron is saying, you're the best of us. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep going, right? And then the culmination of this Great Expectations motif is during the What's Up Danger sequence, where it's at its fullest orchestration. Yes, we have What's Up Danger going, but that kind of flows seamlessly into some score music, and it is so good. And that shot of Miles taking the leap of faith and they invert the camera so that he's falling upward. Yeah. So cool. So cool. That's actually the shot that they use for the soundtrack album, I believe, wow, that I have. So that was me nerding out about the Great Expectations motif, as I'm calling it, because it is so good.
I love everything about that. Yeah, the music is Oscar worthy in my opinion, and
I can't believe he didn't even get a nomination for either so far.
There's always three. They could Return of the King it and sweep.
Yeah, they could, I guess. Anything else about the music?
That's it.
Okay, well, here we are at impact, takeaways, things that you're going to carry with you as you go about in the world. What do you got for Into the Spider-Verse?
The thesis statement seems to be that anyone can wear the mask. That is said at the very end of the film. And between that and sort of Miles' journey, realizing he's not alone, literally the universe is a lot wider than he thought it was. The comfort that we find in others and the comfort that we find in reaching out to others, like the story is solved because characters ask for help. Miles asks Aaron, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. And so this film imparts, I think, a need for community on me. And that is something that I think, although I did admit to not rewatching this film in the years following its release, I think that that message helped me through COVID. Not getting COVID, but the whole pandemic and isolation and how alone that things felt at times. The idea that we were in this together is a very controversial thought these days. You don't always see it, but we're in this world together. The world is so much bigger than us, than any one people. And if we ask for help and if we ask and really respect each other and the trajectory that we are all on, the message I get from this film is you're gonna rock. It's gonna be great, and you know you can accomplish more than you ever thought in your dreams. And so the message is pure but fresh but new but clear, but it's really well done. And definitely, you know, if we do at some point talk about the sequel, there's a lot more really cool, good messaging in that film as well. But from this film, I think it really is just, you know, a focus on community and also the amazing powers within yourself. Really, at the end of the day, has nothing to do with genetically engineered spiders. A lot of this strength that they get is not superpowers and is in fact emotional and inner strength that they're using.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Couple smaller things, and then I have a riff on the same things you were just talking about, even though you already said them very well. We don't get a lot of his mother in this movie. It's more of a focus on his father. We do get more of her in the sequel. But one great thing she says at the beginning of this movie is, our family doesn't run from things, Miles. I really like that just as a concept about facing the things that are difficult in your life, not necessarily to a stupid way, like obviously take care of yourself, but you can't just leave Brooklyn because you're scared of being Spider-Man. Like, that's a poor example because maybe you should, but I just like the idea of not running from your problems. The leap of faith, I really like that as a concept as well, where to know yourself, you're just going to have to take that leap. And in taking the leap, you are yourself ready for the thing, you know? So I really like that. But then, yes, the thing this movie ends with is anyone can wear the mask. And what's presented to us earlier in the film, like right away, is this idea that the powers of Spider-Man are inherently responsibility giving. That's the message that Peter Parker hands to him as he lay dying right before Kingpin deals the final blow, right? He says, you don't have a choice. You have these powers. This is what you have to do now. And you have to use them for good as well. But that's expanded with the idea of anyone can wear the mask. And that first concept is introduced during MJ's speech after Peter dies and everybody's standing around wearing their Spider-Man masks, right? Anyone can wear the mask. It's not spider powers that give you the responsibility to do good. It's just that everyone has a responsibility to do good. There's a quote that I think of often that is attributed to Voltaire, I believe, that goes something like, every man is guilty of the good he did not do.
Ooh.
Guilty of the good he did not do. That is so powerful to me. And that's how I operate so much of my life, is I am here to do good to the world, right? It's not about going out and stopping crime. It's about standing against injustice. It's about helping those who need it. And it's about doing what you can to make the world a better place. And to kind of take that home before we get to our final thoughts, there's a block of text that's given to us in the end credits. That's a quote from Stan Lee. He says, that person who helps others simply because it should or must be done and because it is the right thing to do is indeed, without a doubt, a real superhero. And that's the takeaway here. It's not that anybody can be Spider-Man. It's that anybody can be doing good in the world, whether you're Spider-Man or not.
I mean, it works for me.
So do you have any additional final thoughts, Eric?
I just realized that the sequel is streaming on Netflix at the moment. So awesome. I'm going to rewatch
awesome.
That. It's kicked off a rewatch for me.
I actually just got it on Blu-ray.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah. When I buy home videos again, I'm waiting for that trilogy set. But yeah, no, and I imagine the special features are just insanely good because there's so many talented people that surely would love to explain how they did it. But yeah, I'm blown away by this film, and there really hasn't, barring the sequel, been anything else like it since. And so something can come in here and again, certainly not with as much of a magnifying glass as this film was under in scrutiny, and it just held up. It works on so many levels. It appeals to a broad audience and yet doesn't rest on its laurels, is almost exclusively unique to this as a superhero film. So you know, it very much is a breath of fresh air, a drink of cold water, you know, very refreshing to see. And the team that they've assembled seem to have really just worked. And, you know, it's just a level of fearlessness to do one's own thing that I think is very much in line with the film's message, but has been shown on the part of the people making the film. And that's when something really clicks, when you're like, everyone is on the same page with this.
Yeah, I've already revealed some of the stuff I typed out for my final thought, so I'm not going to reiterate all of it, except that I just like when at the end of the day, no matter how tired I get of superhero movies, I'm always game for a Spider-Man movie. But that said, this one reinvigorated Spidey in a way that I don't think any other Spider-Man film has been able to. They took some of the ideas in this movie and into No Way Home, which made that film so much better. And the trend continues in this film sequel across the Spider-Verse. No exaggeration, this is one of the best animated films ever made. Not just for its innovative animation and music, but because it gave us something new story-wise as well from what we can expect from who Spider-Man can be. And I really love that.
Very well said.
Well, that's the end of the first CineScope episode in 3 years,
Eric. I can't believe that it's been three years, but also I can't believe, you know, because if we were on, you said you did one episode since episode 100 before this, but the idea that How to Train Your Dragon was 3 years ago is just unbelievable. I can't, what is time? I don't get it.
But
I am so touched and honored and thrilled that you invited me not only to come back on the show, but be part of its relaunch here. And as I said at the beginning, but I am just so happy for you and so like just eager to see living your best life. And I love that for you. And I love that this show gets to be back because it was a damn good show. And the idea that you have room for it again in your life speaks to how well you're doing as well. So I'm just so thrilled about all of it. And thank you for having me back.
Thank you, Eric, for being so willing to come back. Like, I texted you last week, and you were like, okay, sure, let's
do it. There's still, like, 18 movies that I would like to talk about with you, so I'm glad the show is back because I was bitter about it. I was like, man, how am I going to talk about it?
I sat down to watch the movie earlier today, and I was like, wow, this is the first time I've taken notes for a movie in a long time, and, like, true to form, it's a long document with lots of notes taken. That's just my style. 5 pages on Google Docs. Well, let's say 4 pages.
Single space.
On Google Docs. So it was a joy to return. I've never said that CineScope was done, right? Like in this 3 year hiatus, I've always said it will be back. Just when, I don't know. And I'm glad I know, and it's back now. So this is the end of the 102nd episode of CineScope. Contact for the show, facebook.com/CineScopePodcast, at CineScopePod on Twitter. You can go over and go to Apple Podcasts to drop a rating and a review and hit that subscribe button. Something of a request is if you have already left a review on Apple Podcasts, but maybe you happen to use the old name, I would be grateful for you to go back and update it for that reason, at least. I'd really appreciate it. And if you haven't left a review before, that would be awesome. That's how people find the show, is Apple Podcasts realizes that there are people out there listening and reviewing and they are enjoying it. So please, I would appreciate that. Thank you very much. If you have email feedback or more direct feedback that you'd like to give or ideas for the show, thecinescopepodcast@gmail.com is the email address for the show's direct contact. Eric, where can we find you online? What do you want to plug?
I am in one place online, which is X or Twitter, formerly Twitter. Still, I'm working on getting off the platform, but it's where I got my biggest following and I still follow the most people on. So anyway, I am at x.com/twitter.com/Spielerman, S-P-I-E-L-E-R-N. What did I even say? S-P-I-E-L-E-R-M-A-N. You can find me on there or contact me on there for everything that I do is hooked in through that Twitter. To heck with it, I am also on Instagram at Eric J. Skull. That's S-C-U-L-L. So take a look there. That's my personal socials, and pretty much I just post about geek stuff and things that I love. Pretty much the concept of this podcast turned into a feed is just me. I'm a big fan of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's it.
So I had to retire the old username, the classic username.
You know what? That's how you know this was real, everybody. If anybody's doubting it, Chelsea had the best Twitter handle of all time, and she let it go to the dogs.
Yeah, so don't worry. The new one is just as silly. The username on Twitter now is ChelseaCC_17. So that's Chelsea spelled the name, the letter C_17. And yes, that will be in the show notes along with all the other contact information. You have my other podcasts to listen to as well. There is the entire archive of An American Workplace, where we talked about The Office, and that was a lot of fun. And yes, we're done, but hey, that was good content too. I'd love for you to listen to it. And then the other podcast, which I actually don't have listed right here, I'll have to add it, is Crossroads of Destiny, which is the Avatar The Last Airbender podcast that I've been doing with two of my best friends the past few years. Also has been on hiatus, but it's coming back too. We're recording like maybe sometime next week. We're trying to figure it out. So if you like Avatar The Last Airbender, or maybe you're excited for the upcoming live action adaptation that's coming to Netflix on February 22nd, we're going to talk about it.
Oh God, another one?
Yeah. We're going to talk about it. So come on over. We're going to have a good time talking about Avatar The Last Airbender. And that's it. Eric, thank you once again for coming back for this special episode of Cinescope. It meant a lot to have you here.
Likewise, Chelsea. It's great to be back.
And thank you, everybody else, for listening. Have fun and celebrate movies. Bye. Pause for just a second because I got to get my cat off my desk.
Oh, Tucker!
Yeah, everybody, Tucker's still around.
Tucker.
He's trying to figure out what to do with himself.
He looks so happy about it.